Peter B. Collins News and Comment on Wednesday, December 4th, 2013, as we learn more about the NSA's dragnet surveillance of Americans and others.
The story is true. Dragnet. Dragnet.
You got a lot of repressed feelings, don't you, Friday? Don't you, Friday? You got a lot of repressed feelings, don't you, Friday? Don't you, Friday?
Well, we'll get to the feelings of Ed Snowden here momentarily. Barton Gellman in the Washington Post reporting today that the NSA has unintentionally, incidentally, collected the cell phone location information on millions of people around the world, including many Americans. But it's all okay and it's legal because they're keeping us safe and they only use the information to see if there's somebody they don't know about who is paralleling the travel plans or travel activities of someone whom they suspect. 5 billion records each day collected on the whereabouts of cell phones around the world. And they hasten to add that it does not target Americans' location data by design, but it acquires a substantial amount of information on the whereabouts of domestic cell phones incidentally. And this is what's so maddening, because Ed Snowden has revealed the truth, that they can collect almost any electronic data they choose. And yet we hear the NSA and our political leaders try to minimize, try to wiggle out of it all. And here's Robert Litt, General Counsel for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that's ODNI, with a very carefully constructed non-denial denial. Quote, there is no element of the intelligence community that under any authority is intentionally collecting bulk cell phone location information about cell phones in the United States. And the key weasel word there is intentionally. So this is just another example of how Big Brother is watching us every minute of every day. And it really, I don't know, it led to a kind of aha moment for me. Because I think back to one of the low points of American spycraft that we know about in recent years. And that was the effort to grab Abu Omar off the streets of Milan at high noon, which we did. We sent Abu Omar back to Egypt where he had been tortured before for another round. And we were caught because we had double-crossed the Italian police authorities that the CIA had been working with in monitoring this jihadist cell in Milan, Italy. And the Italian prosecutor was able to piece together the evidence from cell phone tracking records of about 25 Americans who were deployed there by our CIA. We talked to one of the agents who was involved in that, who's now a whistleblower, a couple of months ago. And what this shows is that the actual level of spycraft by the U.S. Intelligence Committee is remarkably low, at the level of the Keystone Cops with high-tech toys. And if you can handle another image from movies and television, I grew up watching Rocky and Bullwinkle. And one of their little spin-off episodes regards a Cold War spy named Boris Badenov and his wife Natasha. Natasha is this hot, slinky babe, and Boris is this compact guy. And in order to make himself seem bigger and more scary, Boris, the Cold War Russian spy, always carries a flashlight, which he uses to magnify his shadow. And if this is lost on you, if you've never seen Boris Badenov, go to YouTube and find an episode. You got to see this. But that's how I imagine our spook community today. They've got great PR, great imaging, People are afraid of what they're able to do because occasionally they pull something off. They grab somebody, kidnap them, torture them. Yes, they are occasionally successful. But we don't know much about their failures. And if they need to collect 5 billion phone location records a day, that's a whole lot of data. They're drowning in it. That's why they need that huge server farm in Bluffdale, Utah. Now, speaking of the NSA, yesterday in my lead item in the News and Comment podcast, I was actually talking about torture and the way it was micromanaged by the National Security Council at the White House. But I'm so amped up these days about the NSA that I mixed up the NSC, the National Security Council, with the NSA, the National Security Agency, and your humble host deeply regrets the error.
Excuse me.
Today we're releasing to subscribers a Boiling Frogs Post podcast co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds, and our special guest in this episode is Colleen Rowley. She blew the whistle when she worked for the FBI in Minneapolis about the so-called 20th hijacker, Moussaoui. And she was one of the Sam Adams Award winners who went to Moscow a couple of months ago to share the award with Ed Snowden. And in this excerpt from our conversation with Colleen Rowley, she talks about her impression of Ed Snowden. And kind of like the Dragnet song we opened with, people think he's got a lot of repressed feelings, Friday, or that somehow, you know, he's got some personality flaw or deficiency. Take a listen. Colleen Rowley has met Ed Snowden and offers her clear impressions.
The one thing that struck me about Edward Snowden, and we did have a few hours to talk with him, even without his attorney. His attorney was there for a while during the ceremony when we kind of gave speeches, but his attorney left after that, and we actually had a long time to talk. The thing that struck me, and I think I can kind of tell from social media, there are people harbor a certain, even though they might even be thankful for the disclosures, they harbor an idea that he's unstable and or, and no, this was the same type of thing said about Bradley Manning. He's unstable. He's got hurt feelings. He's out for vengeance. He might be giving information to the Russians. There's that type of crazy notion, and it's completely not true. I have not really met anyone who was so squared away and well-grounded, and he really is solely focused on the issue of reform. Now, you would think a person in his situation having to flee to Russia, basically, for asylum, with politicians in the United States calling for him to be put on the kill list, you would think that that he would, be a little traumatized by that. You know, it's quite an experience to go through. And yet, really, he kept bringing the conversation back to how the massive spying, the NSA's massive spy operation, can be fixed, and about what efforts could be launched in Europe and in the United States. He had just given a statement that was read by proxy to the European Union Committee on Human Rights the week before. And so there was this discussion on how that could be, you know, built on, and maybe in the United States, how he could testify somehow, maybe through written means, but at least he could have some input into these discussions and debate. So not at all concerned about himself, but solely concerned still about the issues. I think it's the one thing that many people miss, because they want to focus on the personal instead of on the issues. And the only reason he did sacrifice so much was because he wanted to see this fixed.
You can hear the full interview with Colleen Rowley, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. It's available to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And I always like to thank the people who subscribe to this podcast and keep it all going, pay my bills for the internet and the phone, and make this whole thing work. And today I want to thank Wesley Colangelo, Don Cisney, Steve Lane, Michael Petty, all subscribers here at peterbcollins.com. And of course, the other way you can support our work is by clicking on the banner ad that is now up on the homepage at peterbcollins.com, and that's from audible.com. And the way it works, Audible has over 150,000 audiobooks available for download, and if you take out a trial account using the link that I provide, you're going to win, not win, but they will give you your first audiobook download free. And you can listen on your iPhone, Android, Kindle, MP3 player in your car, however you do it. So here's the skinny. You sign up today for a free 30-day trial, and if you cancel before 30 days, you won't owe Audible a dime. Your first audiobook is free. You get to keep it. And Audible.com will pay me $15 for each trial membership. So share this with friends and family. You can give it as a holiday gift if you like. It's a no-risk, no-cost way that you can kick in $15 to support this podcast and get a free audiobook in the process. The link's in the show file. It's in the banner ad. And you can also just go directly to audibletrial.com/PeterBCollins. That's audible.com/PeterBCollins. And it has the Chloe Rose seal of approval. She's barking in the background just to let you know that.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, I've got that. What's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's
okay.
Going on.
All right, I want you to stand on the line with me. Where are you in the school?
I'm down the corridor.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get the sergeant.
This is the sound from the 911 calls that were made from Sandy Hook Elementary School last December on the day that Adam Lanza went on a shooting spree there, according to the accounts that we've been given.
It's still happening.
You're hearing the voice of janitor Rick Thorne.
All right. What about the students in the front of the building?
Everything's locked up as far as I know. I'm not in the front.
All right, you're in lockdown?
They're in lockdown.
Did you see anything out the window?
No, it's still going on. I can't get over there.
Okay, I don't want you to go over there. I want to know what's happening with the students, though, along the front corridors. This is in the front parking lot?
Yes. I'm not in the front. I'm actually down the other part, but I'm close.
Now, this is the first recording I've had a chance to listen to, and I have to say that it's interesting. You hear people who are maintaining their cool in a crisis situation, and I think that is remarkable. And I don't know if there is anything new to be gleaned from the 7 phone call recordings that were released under a court order in Connecticut today. What concerns me the most is the struggle that took place to keep these calls from ever being publicly released. And we were told that it's too painful for family members who lost a loved one, a child or one of the educators at Sandy Hook last year. But nobody is required to listen to these, including people right there at the crime scene. What is really at stake here is the standard of public records, of public access, and that information about a crime cannot be suppressed. And it is the struggle to suppress this that has really gotten more attention than, so far, the contents of the tape recordings themselves. And last night on her MSNBC show, Rachel Maddow really upset me. Because she went to great lengths, and in her first story, she often, I think, labors the issue by larding on too much information. But she did this whole setup about how the media has elected, not because anybody told them to, not to show the grisly pictures of people who jumped from the Twin Towers on September 11th of 2001. And she offers other examples where we sanitize the coverage of events for various reasons. And the media is well within its rights to decide what images to use and what images to withhold from the public. But the idea that the legislature in Connecticut could block the release by passing a law, that the information here would be suppressed, raises more questions than I think will ever be answered by the recordings themselves. And I was really disappointed because Rachel Maddow, like me, yesterday, had not heard any of these recordings. And yet she was arguing that they should continue to be suppressed. And I'm sorry, that violates my First Amendment interpretation. And it should be the same for Rachel Maddow, in my humble opinion. Well, yesterday, the House finally passed some gun legislation after balking at any meaningful changes following the spate of mass killings that we've had, including the Washington Navy Yard, going back to Virginia Tech, the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting, and, of course, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. And the cowards in the House were permitted to vote on this without sanction from the NRA, and the legislation is a simple extension of the ban on plastic guns. Now, this ban was mostly theoretical until recently. The development of 3D printers makes it possible to create a gun from a 3D printer entirely made out of plastic. You could carry it through a metal detector and fire it, presumably, on a plane. And so the House, by a voice vote, so that we don't know which way some of the gun nuts voted, they passed this bill, which is an extension of the existing ban on plastic guns. Chuck Schumer, Democratic senator from New York, says that the current law allows for detachable metal parts that can be removed before a gun is passed through a metal detector. And there may be some changes to the bill in the Senate version that'll have to be reconciled at conference. But it's interesting and also shameful that after all of these events, we have done absolutely nothing except extend this plastic gun ban to protect innocent Americans from gun violence. And I'm under no illusions that passing a law, even an automatic weapons ban, can change the course of human behavior. But to do nothing, to me, that is fully unconscionable. Some developments in the Middle East. Secretary of State John Kerry and the American team are going to present to Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel detailed ideas about security arrangements on the West Bank under a possible peace agreement with the Palestinians. This will happen on Thursday. John Allen, the former American commander in Afghanistan, now a retired Marine general who serves as an advisor to Kerry on the Middle East, will be the point person on this. And I think that this may not be a pivotal event, but it shows that the U.S. diplomatic team is stepping up its efforts to get involved in these talks that have been going on quietly without much news of any real progress. And the issues of security have been a major point of contention. Israel claims that on the Palestinian portions of the West Bank that they want to deploy Israeli troops. And that clearly is unacceptable to the Palestinians in the context of a two-state solution. Meanwhile, today, the situation is complicated by the shooting death of the military commander of Hezbollah in Beirut, Lebanon. He was shot outside his South Beirut apartment, and this follows on the heels of the killing of the military leader of Hezbollah last year. And so far, Israel is denying any responsibility, but of course they do even when they are responsible. And there is a plausible explanation. Hezbollah has been involved in the civil war in Syria. And because of its proximity to Lebanon, it's easily a possibility that this was not caused by Israel. But I think we have to be honest about who stands the most to gain from any efforts to destabilize Hezbollah. So there is a previously unknown Sunni group that is claimed responsible for this attack, and it'll remain to be seen if we ever find out exactly who is responsible. Likewise, about 10 days ago, I reported to you new investigations into the death of the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. And the suggestion is that he was poisoned using polonium, the radioactive material. A new extensive study by French scientists have determined, and Arafat's widow has endorsed the findings, that they are ruling out poisoning by radioactive polonium. I don't know much more about that, but wanted to pass along that correction to the record, at least from the recent reports. Here in the United States, fast food workers in about 100 cities and perhaps more plan to walk off the job tomorrow, Thursday, which could be the largest effort yet to push for higher pay for these people who work in fast food restaurants under almost sweatshop conditions, many of them earning only about $7.25 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage. And once again, we're embroiled in this battle to raise the minimum wage to somewhere near a living wage. And we always hear, predictably, from the right and the people they patronize in the House, the conservative Republicans, that there will be fewer jobs if you raise the minimum wage. And the truth is, we've seen this play out time and time again, where the economy is flexible and resilient enough to absorb increases to the minimum wage in ways that actually help the whole economy, because people earning minimum wage will spend virtually everything they earn. You give them more money, they'll buy more burgers. And so the Ayn Rand school of thought that increasing the minimum wage will reduce the number of minimum wage jobs has not proven to be true in any of the increases to the minimum wage in my lifetime. And I'm not prepared to believe that that is about to change. Here in San Francisco last week, you may know that President Obama came and gave a staged speech, a photo op, about immigration reform, trying to pressure Republicans in the House to move forward. And the president was interrupted by a brave young man who he's what we call a dreamer. He is currently not subject to deportation because of intervention at the executive branch by President Obama. And this young man interrupted the president during his speech and said that he wanted the president to stop the deportations of undocumented residents of the United States. And on Sunday, the former mayor of San Francisco, Willie Brown, who is quite a gadfly and a very complex figure, he has a weekly column in the San Francisco Chronicle, and he opened his column by apologizing. He says, "On behalf of the city, Mr. President, I apologize for our bad behavior." And former Mayor Brown tweaked current Mayor Lee for not properly vetting the props, the human props, who were asked to provide the backdrop for the president's photo op. And that one of these props actually is a living, feeling human entity who spoke up seems to offend the political sensibilities of one Willie Brown. Well, I want to commend John Carroll, who is a daily columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle. And today he pushed back on Willie Brown with an excellent refutation. I'll put up a link to it, and that'll be in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Juan Cole is a professor at the University of Michigan. He has been a frequent contributor on this program, and I value the work that he does. And he has the Informed Comment blog, which is at juancole.com. And currently, one of his posts is a reaction to the commentary about how corrupt the government of Afghanistan is. And it is. But what he says is that the hopeless corruption in the United States is never compared to the hopeless corruption in other countries. So I'm going to run through the list of 10 ways that the U.S. is the most corrupt country in the world, according to Professor Cole, and I think his comments are dead on. First, he talks about our campaign finance system, which is a system of bribery. Then the way that captured industries or regulatory capture takes place when industries like banking know how to bribe the leadership and get the rules, regulations, and laws that they want. That's pretty corrupt. That the chief villains of the 2008 meltdown have not been prosecuted. That's a form of corruption. The U.S. military budget is bloated, enormous, bigger than the military budgets of the next 12 major states. It's a corporate welfare on a cosmic scale. Yeah, that's corruption. The vast gulag of 2.2 million prisoners in jail and penitentiary, very, very well placed on this list. Number six, the rich are well placed to bribe our politicians to reduce taxes on the rich. And that's corrupt. The National Security Agency's domestic spying is a form of corruption. Insider trading. Congress undid much of the law it hastily passed forbidding members to engage in insider trading. I didn't know they had unpassed that law. Asset forfeiture in the drug wars, corrupting police departments and the judiciary. Juan Cole mostly focuses on foreign policy, and I'm glad to hear him talk about the way the war on some drugs provides this slush fund money for police departments. And actually, I made a comment about that without knowing about Cole's remark here in an interview that we'll be releasing next week with Professor Carl Hart of Columbia University. And his 10th item, money and corruption have seeped so far into our media system that people can, with a straight face, assert that scientists aren't sure human carbon emissions are causing global warming. And yes, that is corrupt. Professor Juan Cole. Finally today, I want to share with you a couple of very interesting spots. These are television commercials. They relate to a different form of corruption in this country, and that is the concept embraced by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Citizens United decision of corporate personhood. And this is now potentially going to the next level, where challenges to Obamacare by private corporations that don't want to provide health insurance that includes contraception to employees are arguing that that violates the religious freedom of the corporation, not the individual. So, a very clever man named Dennis Traynor Jr. sent me a link to these spots, and I'm going to play two of them for you. And I'll put the link up in the show file so you can watch them with the pictures, because they do have high impact and they're kind of sexy. There's a sexual element to these spots that I will try to describe. And they attack corporate personhood in a very clever and amusing way. And the title of the commercial package is called Why Douche Waffles Get Elected.
When corporate money is considered free speech, corporations buy elections. When corporations buy elections, douche waffles get elected to high office.
Politician just threw a baby.
When waffles get elected to high office, you hurl a throwing star at your television. When you hurl a throwing star at your television, you accidentally kill the mailman. When you accidentally kill the mailman, you never receive that love letter from the supermodel who has secretly loved you since elementary school. When you never receive that love letter from the supermodel who has secretly loved you since elementary school,
now
you
a domination
never get to
sex scene.
Well, you know, don't miss that love letter. Get rid of corporate rule. Amend the Constitution. Sign the petition at movetoamend.org.
Now, I don't know that I would bring the dominatrix theme or the fantasy about a dominatrix scene with a supermodel or a movie star, but I give them high marks here. I think that this is an attention grabber. And it may help people who don't understand corporate personhood or the need to amend the Constitution to get a better grip on that. Let's listen to one more of these.
When corporations hijack democracy, you get despondent. When you get despondent, your libido takes a nosedive. When your libido takes a nosedive, your wife spikes your dinner with erectile dysfunction pills. When your wife spikes your dinner with erectile dysfunction pills, you become that guy who suffers from erections lasting longer than 4 hours. When you become that guy who suffers from erections lasting longer than 4 hours, your doctor castrates you to relieve the pain. And when your doctor castrates you to relieve the pain, you become a soprano in a community theater production of Cats. Don't do Cats. Get rid of corporate rule. Amend the Constitution. Sign the petition at movetoamend.org.
Be sure to check them out. Maybe put them up on your Facebook page and share them with people. I think this is a very clever way to get out a message that's generally done in a kind of wonky manner. Happy trails to you. I will speak to you again on Monday, December 9th. I'll be away for a few days. Hope things don't change too much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.